this week's program, a conversation with Alan Gilbert, music director designate of the New York Philharmonic. He's in town to lead the Philadelphia Orchestra in a series of concerts this week. Next week, he'll be conducting the Curtis Institute of Music Symphony Orchestra in performances of Mahler's transcription of Beethoven's Opus 95. Susan Lewis looks at the music and life of Beethoven and how Opus 95 fits into the great composer's body of work. And we'll hear from David De Chiara. The Opera Company of Philadelphia is presenting the East Coast premiere of his new work, Cyrano. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Many heads in the music world turned last year when the New York Philharmonic announced that the successor to music director Lauren Mazel would be a young conductor now at the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic named Alan Gilbert. The 40-year-old conductor is well known to a number of New York Philharmonic musicians off the podium as well as on it. He grew up in the orchestra family where both his parents played violin. His mother, Yoko Takibi, still plays there. His father, Michael Gilbert, retired in 2001. As a musician himself, Gilbert got his early professional start in the Philadelphia area. After studying violin and viola at the Curtis Institute of Music, he substituted with the Philadelphia Orchestra and was music director of the Haddonfield Symphony, now the Camden-based Symphony in C. With this new position, he steps into an international spotlight in his own backyard. Despite the skeptics, those who would question his age or experience, the news of his appointment was met with enthusiasm by the orchestra. Musicians cite his superb technique, musicality and communication skills, important for any artistic director, vital when conducting one's own mother. I met with Alan Gilbert earlier this week and asked him what he felt were the skills that had brought him so far, so young.
It's so important to, of course, know the repertoire, to have done your preparation so that you're technically capable of dealing with a large body of music, to have a sense of what an efficient way to use a rehearsal is. I mean, there are a lot of skills and there are a lot of capacities that are engaged when you're conducting. But also really important is to be deeply familiar with orchestras and to have some kind of an insight into the mentality and the psychology of orchestra musicians. How to deal with an orchestra in a way that is comfortable for the orchestra and that will lead them to accept you. And it's, you know, you might have great musical ideas, but you have to function, call it socially, in an effective way with an orchestra. And at the very least, I can say that I've grown up around orchestras. You know, my parents having been violinists in the New York Philharmonic.
And indeed, you sat in this orchestra on many occasions and saw what conductors do well and don't do well.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the strongest, most important components of my education was the period of time I spent playing in the Philadelphia Orchestra as a violinist. I was on the substitute musician list, and I played pretty much all the time for a couple of years, and that was revelatory. I actually playing in the orchestra was just another dimension of insight into what it feels like to be an orchestra musician. But you know, it's amazing in an orchestra like this, the extent that the players take their work seriously. And you know, you'd think that in the greatest orchestras, oh, everyone can play it, they're technically so proficient, they can probably coast. Actually, that's not what happens at all. The better the orchestra, the more preparation the players do. And it's the less good orchestras where you see people not taking their parts home. I remember with standard repertoire here in the Philadelphia Orchestra, I was playing in the second violin section, of course, and with standard repertoire, I would sometimes go to the library to get my part, and all the parts were out. People took their parts home to practice them, even with pieces that probably had literally been played hundreds of times by these musicians. And I was so impressed, and I realized how much the players bring to the table themselves. And that's something that, as a conductor, it's really important to realize, both because it gives you a dimension of respect that is really important, I think, in terms of creating a good working relationship. But also it helps you because you realize that there are a lot of things that you can use and that you can access from the musicians in terms of their energy and their enthusiasm and their professionalism. And it's a kind of clarification of something that you talk about, but it's hard to actually realize until you truly sense it in the situation. The fact of conducting being a real it's a question of communication and of meeting the orchestra halfway. And it's not just that I stand here and conduct and you guys figure out what I want. We're making the music together. And that kind of sense, if you have it and if you've lived it, I think that gives you a chance to succeed. And musicians will go a long way to help you out if they really feel that you're trusting them and that you believe in them and that you understand what they have to offer.
Tell me about conducting your mother. There's a story doing the rounds about her making a mistake and her esteemed son putting her straight.
Well, it's actually, the story is true. I don't know the version you heard, but it's there's no need to exaggerate it because it's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. It was the first time, literally the first rehearsal I ever did conducting the New York Philharmonic. And I was doing a very complicated piece, actually the same piece I did in Philadelphia a few years ago when I conducted here, the Stenhammer Serenade. And it's a very delicate, difficult piece for the orchestra. And near the beginning, there's a spot where the first four violins, that is to say the first two stands, have little solos, each one coming in after the other. And it was almost the end of the rehearsal. I remember we had been going for, you know, almost the 2.5 hours, and we got to that spot, and I went back to that spot, and my mother came in slightly late. You know, it was understandable. It was an unfamiliar piece, and, you know, it's a very quick canonic entrance, that she was slightly late. And so I stopped the orchestra, and I remember feeling immediately the sense in the orchestra of wondering,
what's he going to...
Yeah. It was clear that I stopped for that because I looked and everyone was wondering, what's he going to say now? And I didn't plan it, but I just said what came to my mind, and it was, "Mom." And people started to giggle, and then they started to laugh. And as they thought about it, they laughed more. And finally, the whole stage was just completely... It was crazy because everyone was just howling with laughter because, you know, you just don't expect to hear the word "mom" in the context of an orchestra rehearsal like with the New York Philharmonic and have it make sense. It was just such a warm, and it was just amazing. I mean, they were laughing so hard that the rehearsal ground to a halt. The offices, which are on the sixth floor, you know, they have an audio feed, so they heard, and people from the office came and said, "What was going on the stage?" Because, you know, it was crazy. And after a few minutes of, you know, everyone, you know, I could see people with tears in their eyes because they were laughing so hard, it sort of settled down, and I said, you know, it was a little late, and then I said to the orchestra, "I've been waiting for years to do that." And then it just started all over again. People were laughing. I mean, there were people who came up to me after that rehearsal and said, "That is the funniest moment that I can remember in 40 years playing in the orchestra." And that's what happened. And the nice thing about it is that you couldn't have planned it because, you know, we were playing a piece in which she, as the fourth chair violinist, had a solo. That's unusual in the first place. And a little mishap happened. You know, they don't make that many mistakes in the New York Philharmonic. A little thing happened, and I was conducting, and she was my mom. So it was just a charming moment, and it was the rehearsal, if I remember correctly, had been going fine, but that really was an icebreaker. And you asked about conducting my mom. I was very aware of it, obviously, especially in that first rehearsal. But as time has gone on, as I've had the chance to work with the orchestra over and over again, that dimension has receded, and other things have taken over. And in the best sense, it feels quite normal now to work with the orchestra. I'm not thinking all the time about the fact that my mom is sitting over to my left.
Because you've had close associations with this region, with Symphony in C, when it was the Haddonfield Symphony, you were at Curtis, there are a multitude of Alan Gilbert anecdotes and stories, and there are definitely people who have a certain impression of you. And the one that was most interesting for me is that somebody described you in Teddy Roosevelt terms as being somebody who spoke quietly and carried a small stick. You've taken things at your own pace. Will that be the case when you take up the music directorship of the New York Philharmonic?
I'll try to be myself. In terms of planning my moves career-wise, I've definitely never tried to bite off more than I could chew. And I've been content to be patient. The Stockholm Philharmonic, where I've been working for the last 8 years, is a terrific orchestra. But honestly, one of the things that appealed to me was the fact that it was slightly off the beaten track. It's not a city in which there's constant worldwide media scrutiny. And I've been able to work, you know, in relative peace and cover a lot of ground, and I think get a lot of valuable experience. You know, obviously now there's a kind of big qualitative jump that's taking place with my appointment in New York. It's the real deal. I mean, there's nothing preparatory about it. I have to, you know, dive in and hit the ground running. So I don't think that I intend to be cautious in any way. However, the way I work with people is, I guess you could say, relatively low-key. But I do intend to achieve the results that I envision in my head. And I'm willing to, you know, do what it takes to make that happen. So, you know, it's not necessary to speak loudly and to throw temper tantrums in order to get what you want. It's just, and it's also just not the way I do things. So I'm hoping that it will be what I fully expect it to be, which is a collegial, positive atmosphere in which, on some level, everybody wants the same result. And I know that there's a great enthusiasm, certainly internally within the institution of the New York Philharmonic, and also surrounding the organization. You know, with the people who are interested in the public that the orchestra serves, and the people who are working in the media. There's a lot of interest for things to go in a certain direction. So I have a feeling I'll be able to use momentum that's already there. And in a sense, it doesn't feel as if I'm going to have to start, you know, setting off explosions. That having been said, I imagine that people will find that things are quite different, simply because I'm different. And what I hope happens is that my personality and the chemistry and the combination of my personality with that of the orchestra will create something that is necessarily fresh because it's never happened before.
And because of your age, there's also the potential for it to be a very long relationship if it goes well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that remains to be seen, but there's certain kind of work that can only be accomplished by a conductor and an orchestra that have been working together for a long time. There's a familiarity that allows the work to go into a different realm, and we're not in the age of an Ormandy length tenure. That's virtually unheard of. I think it is unheard of right now. So, you know, probably we're not talking about that, but, you know, I hope it's long enough that we can actually go through certain natural phases and achieve things that take time.
Music director designate of the New York Philharmonic, Alan Gilbert. He conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall in a program featuring Hilberg's The Exquisite Corpse, Bartok's Concerto for Two Pianos, Percussion and Orchestra featuring Emmanuel Ax and Yoko Nozaki, and Carl Nielsen's Second Symphony. On Monday, Gilbert is back on the Verizon Hall podium to face the Curtis Symphony Orchestra. It's the conclusion of a school-wide exploration of Beethoven, and in particular his Opus 95 string quartet. The concert features Mahler's transcription of the work for orchestra. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers Beethoven, the man, and his music.
Born in Bonn, Germany in 1770, Ludwig von Beethoven came of age in Europe during the tumultuous time of the French Revolution. With a father who hoped he'd be the next Mozart, Ludwig learned music seriously from an early age. He studied piano, organ, and viola and moved to Vienna in 1792, where he studied with Haydn. Unlike many of his peers who maintained church or court positions, Beethoven worked as an independent musician, earning his living from patron stipends, as well as income from concerts and the sales of his works. Bruce Adolph, composer and resident lecturer at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, says Beethoven changed the nature of the way music was written and understood.
Beethoven is an extreme example of someone who was always breaking new ground, always considering new ideas, forever looking for a new way to hear, a new kind of harmony, a new kind of cadence, a new kind of drama.
The result was universal music infused with both intensity of joy and suffering that was interpreted in various ways. Different schools of musicians who came afterward claimed him as a model, says Richard Friedman, professor of music at Haverford College.
They're seeing in Beethoven a mirror of their own interests. So if you want music to be about itself, for the Brahms Hanslick camp in Vienna in the 1870s and 1880s, that's exactly how they were able to read Beethoven. But for the Liszt Wagner camp, who wanted to see music as a reflection of ideas outside itself, Beethoven's music became the model of extra musical expression in musical form.
Over the course of his life, Beethoven composed 16 string quartets. The Curtis Institute of Music chose Opus 95, or Quartetto Serioso, as the focus of a mini-festival of sorts.
It's like a musical time bomb.
Curtis violinist Sylvia Kim.
Have these short little bursts of very violent playing and then all of a sudden quickly have to switch to another gear. And it's a little schizophrenic.
Lincoln Center's Bruce Adolph uses the metaphor of Tourette's syndrome to describe the piece. With its convulsive tics, its restive nature, and seemingly involuntary bursts of energy.
Because I suddenly saw the piece as a suffering human being.
Adolph says this 20-minute compressed work illustrates some of Beethoven's most innovative music-making.
Groundbreaking ideas. It's unpredictable. It's full of anxiety and suffering at the same time as it has moments of joy.
The Beethoven program at Curtis involves not only performance, but study, discussion, and analysis of the composer's work and life. Curtis president Roberto Diaz says the way Beethoven worked, leaving sketches, letters, and papers, facilitates this holistic educational approach.
Getting into his creative process is really a wonderful experience. And you see what was going on in his life and how that affected how his music sounds.
How Beethoven's life affected his music has been subject to speculation. His life had all the drama of opera. His mother died when he was 16. His father struggled with alcohol addiction. Ludwig took care of his two younger brothers. Later, when one brother died, he sought custody of his orphaned nephew. He had at least one doomed love affair, and in his 20s, he famously began losing his hearing, a devastating impairment for a musician. The minds behind the music were explored in a course at Curtis called More Than Words, Composers' Lives Revealed Through Letters. Composer Virginia Allen, who taught the course, believes the letters provide insight into the composer's innermost thoughts.
One of the things that you see very clearly about Beethoven was that he was very passionate. He was passionate about his music. He was passionate about good things. He was also passionate when things went badly. And that passion comes across so clearly within his music.
Scholars like Haverford College's Richard Friedman are quick to point out that the passion in Beethoven's music, while no doubt informed by his personal experience, shouldn't be read as a biographical record of his emotional ups and downs. Even the way his music has been categorized for study reflects the benefit of hindsight. Described by textbooks as a bridge between classicism and romanticism, Beethoven's works are often grouped into three periods. His 16-string quartets span all three periods and illustrate his stylistic evolution, to a point, says Friedman. First, the classical period, where he composed quartets that recall Haydn, like Opus 18, a middle period in which Beethoven created quartets with music that was less intimate than the late quartets, which seemed to baffle his contemporaries.
They're 5, 6, 7 movements long. They're huge theme and variation pieces, huge fugues. These are difficult, big pieces. In lots of ways, they really were works of the 20th century. And to the extent that 19th century listeners heard them, they thought that Beethoven had gone off his rocker, and the chief explanation of those pieces really was Beethoven's deafness.
Friedman says the interesting thing about Opus 95, ostensibly in his middle period, is not how it fits within this analysis, but how it doesn't. It's a middle period work that poses the issues more common in his later quartets. The work was, says Bruce Adolph, an exploration of possibilities.
Beethoven changes the idea of what the stress and strain you can put on a musical structure is. How can you tear it apart and still keep it comprehensible? How is something still cohesive when it keeps darting off in different directions? And this piece was an experiment for him.
That Beethoven considered his Opus 95 a difficult work is evident from his letters, says Virginia Allen.
In 1816, he wrote a letter to Sir George Smart over in England, and he said that this was not to be performed in public. It was to be performed just for a small circle of connoisseurs. And he really believed that it was something that would be so unfamiliar to audiences who were used to listening to salon music that was more entertaining, that this would be difficult for some people to be able to understand.
Nearly 200 years later, this Quartetto Serioso has been performed in public many times, analyzed with humorous metaphors, and transcribed for orchestra by Gustav Mahler, the arrangement of which will be performed by the Curtis Orchestra next week under the direction of Curtis alumnus Alan Gilbert, the next music director of the New York Philharmonic. Gilbert says Opus 95 is Beethoven at its most distilled and concise.
There's a lot that can be gleaned and learned from this piece because it presents so much material in such a compact form. While it is quite different from the quartet version to hear it played by many players, it really works orchestrally and it packs a tremendous musical punch.
Despite Beethoven's reservations about this piece, his increasing personal isolation as his deafness worsened, and the puzzled reactions his later works evoked, Beethoven emerges from history a triumph. His music so innovative, so alive, so daring, that as often as it's played, it still has the ability to alternately move us and then take us by surprise.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Alan Gilbert conducts the Curtis Symphony Orchestra in performances of Mahler's transcription of Beethoven's Opus 95 on Monday at the Kimmel Center and on Tuesday at Carnegie Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Last night, the Opera Company of Philadelphia presented its first performance of Cyrano, a new work by composer David De Chiara and librettist Bernard Uzan. The Pennsylvania-born De Chiara is not your typical opera composer, if there's such a thing. Educated and trained as a pianist and composer, he studied in Italy as a Fulbright scholar in the late 1950s and joined the music faculty of Oakland University in 1962, where he eventually became chairman of the music department. But his professional life took him from academia to arts management, where he made his name as a vigorous promoter of opera, often assuming artistic, managerial, and advocacy roles. De Chiara's longest association has been with Michigan Opera Theatre, which he took from a new venture in 1971 to one of the few opera companies in the United States with its own opera house. In the early 2000s, with the Opera Company of Philadelphia and Cincinnati Opera, De Chiara's Detroit-based company co-commissioned and co-presented Richard Danielpour and Toni Morrison's opera Margaret Garner. De Chiara's own first grand opera outing comes with the composer, now aged 72, so when I met with him earlier this week, I first asked if this was a classic case of late blooming.
I had given up composing in a very serious way many years before, because when I was working and studying in the early 60s and so forth, composers were pretty much involved in academia. And the academic picture in composition in the States was a very, very narrow field, and it was very much dedicated to people who were writing both atonal and serial and electronic music, etc.
Whereas that's by no way a school that you come from.
I didn't have anything to say in that. I mean, I appreciated it, and, you know, I've taught it and all of that, but it was not my language. So as I began over the years in producing opera, became involved in promoting composers, I began to see a trend going back where composers felt comfortable using all kinds of musical language, whether it was music that expressed some of their ethnic backgrounds, or whether it was Baroque or neoclassic or romantic or contemporary or a mixture of many. It's a very different picture today in composition than it was 35 years ago.
That said, you are a fan of the great lush melody.
Well, I am for myself.
Right, but that's also reflected in your writing.
Right, because that's how I express my emotions in music. But I, of course, am a tremendous fan of many composers and many styles. The important thing is that I think that there is a validity and there's a sense of liberty today that composers really can feel free to use whatever language they want, particularly when they're using it to express a theatrical idea or text and drama. You know, so I finally kind of felt liberated to be myself.
Usually when we speak to composers, we ask them the question about what they heard in their head as compared to what they saw on the stage. It probably wasn't as big a revelation for you because you had the experience of repeatedly taking the work off the page and putting
right.
it on the stage. But I'll still ask you the question.
Sure.
How surprised were you when you saw it staged?
Well, you know, it is very surprising because it's yours. And you never quite know how it will transfer itself to the stage. I was lucky because I did two workshops. And that gave all of us, the team, the opportunity to see how the drama unfolded, how it projected not only in a small room but on the stage. We learned things, we made adjustments. And in a way, too, it was kind of interesting to be part of producing it and working with designers and conductors and all that stuff, you know, trying to make sure that you tried to get everything right as best you could anyhow.
Your other most recent experience of producing work by a living composer was that with Richard Daniel for
Garner, right.
And you talked then about the advantages of having the composer in the room while you were preparing the production.
Oh, absolutely.
How much of an advantage was it having the composer in your head when you were producing this work?
Yeah, right. I tell you the one thing, which I tried very hard, even in this production of Cyrano, I was always wearing two hats, the composer and then the producer. And I realized, for example, when I was doing Margaret Garner, that there were a number of things that, as the producer, I felt needed adjustments. And I often, you know, Richard was often adamantly opposed to it. And so it was interesting. And sometimes I had to fight for some of those things. I lost some and gained some. But I told myself often, okay, David, you know, you're dealing with yourself as a producer and as a composer. Be cognizant of both. Maybe there's not a cut you want to make, but maybe it really does make sense, you know. And so let's do it. You know? So I think I was more practical, perhaps, in some of the decisions I made than if I was just a composer.
And then your colleagues then went into the role of having to approach you as the composer,
right,
Captain Hat.
Right.
How was
and
that?
That was very easy. I said, okay,
We'll have to ask them about that.
Yeah, you ask them.
Composer David De Chiara. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of his Cyrano is at the Academy of Music through February 17th. And that's our program. Our thanks this week to Jennifer Reisers, Tracy Gallagher and Lauren Saul. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.